YDT. Guys, that was a perfect double match, AC2 YDT.
Don't worry, Matt. The cue of the individual resonators really tells you how sharp, how high in quality, and that was sort of Joe's original question. I know we've gone very far afield of your original question, Joe, but still, the way you were testing that crystal between a signal generator and a spectrum analyzer, you really were starting to use it in a bandpass filter characteristic, and we now know a little bit more about its series resonance, parallel resonance, methods of combining lots of crystals with just the right assembly structure, lattice network with the right coupling coefficients. You can synthesize very high quality shapes of flatness across the bandpass of the filter, steep skirts on the sides, and a pleasant sound as far as the audio is concerned coming through them. My guess is you don't intend to go anywhere near as far as Mel did. Mel went out and bought himself a zillion crystals. He could buy them cheaply for the chrominance frequency, 3.579545. Those crystals that are in every single television set, analog television set in the old days, those were a dime a dozen, so to speak. So he was selecting those and making a sophisticated filter out of them. A very enthusiastic project. I don't recommend you go there unless you really want to study the science of filtering, because it can chew up a lot of time, as you can tell from what Mel went through. And as I said, I know we went very far afield, but maybe you can bring us back to what your real question was, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, it was really just a curiosity question, actually, what I was seeing, because I was noticing a flat line sort of on the tracking generator. I don't think I had it set to a width of about 20 or 30 megahertz, and it had the center of the screen tuned to 44.5, and pretty close to 44.645, which is what was stamped on the crystal case. I saw an extreme, very sharp dip. I didn't really notice much of a peak right next to it where you said it's supposed to be. If it went up slightly, maybe just a little bit. I was really just using clip leads. I really didn't have any way of coupling the thing. But as I said also before, I noticed another extremely sharp dip, but not quite as deep at 44.715. So I think that's what my question was. Why I was seeing two dips. I thought that looked a little unusual. Back to you.
Yeah, you didn't give us the units. 44.715. Was that kilohertz, 44.715 megahertz? But that was the second dip. Tell me once again what was the first dip, and tell me the units. Over to you, Joe.
All in megahertz. 44.645 is the first frequency. And, am I doing that right? 44.645 and 44.715 approximately. Maybe 717.
If you find the right article on the methods of testing crystals for all of their bandpass and bandstop frequency characteristics, every crystal has a fundamental series and parallel, and then many other harmonic frequencies of resonance, third, fifth, and seventh. Usually the odd harmonics are the stronger ones. The even harmonics are not quite as strong. So many crystals, when they're used in harmonics, are used on an odd harmonic, and in between, you'll find a whole bunch of very minor little squiggles of crystal response versus frequency. Call them the spurious modes, if you like. Very similar to, depending on how you hit the surface of a drum, whether you hit it in the center or one-third of the way from the center to the side, way out to the side, hit the rim, you can make different kinds of sounds out of a drum, depending on how you hit it. You're setting up different modes of oscillation of that stretched skin across the drum. Well, a crystal, a quartz crystal, a piezoelectric material, has a similar characteristic. There are many other kinds of modes. When the crystal manufacturer does a good job of selecting, grinding, building, mounting, and whatever, and testing, he is guaranteeing how many decibels down will the spurious modes be. And if your oscillator circuit is properly designed, it will only oscillate on the desired fundamental or harmonic mode. When you've got two modes that are very close together, like you talked about, 44.645 megacycles and 44.715. If that was the third harmonic, and by the way, rarely is a crystal used beyond roughly 20 megacycles, if I remember correctly, in the fundamental mode. Whenever a crystal is used beyond 20 or 25 megacycles, there's a magic number there. Well, you don't go beyond in the fundamental mode. So all crystals at higher frequencies are operating on some harmonic. You can buy a crystal oscillator circuit that runs at 115 megahertz. In some cases, it's running on the seventh harmonic of that crystal. And by the way, the seventh harmonic, the sixth, the fifth harmonic, the third harmonic are not exactly three times and five times and seven times the fundamental. There's a couple of other funny phenomena go on where the offset is a little bit from the exact multiple of the fundamental. And whether it's higher or lower, I'm not quite sure. But if that crystal of yours at 44 megacycles was on its third harmonic mode, for instance, and if those two modes were only 100 kilohertz apart at 44 megacycles, that would not be a properly designed and selected crystal for that third harmonic frequency. Obviously, there's probably a 50-50 chance that your particular oscillator circuit would hop on one or the other, and that would not be desirable. So I am guessing that particular crystal was not emphasizing that third harmonic mode at its original
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
At its original manufacturer. What was the fundamental frequency stamped on the crystal, if you know, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y? K-2-L-I-W?
44.645. It's the second local oscillator crystal used in a Motorola GM300. Because the radio exhibited, I had squelch noise, put a carrier in on the antenna input, at like minus 10 dBm, couldn't hear it. I started stepping around to see if the second local oscillator was working, and it wasn't. So I lost the second local oscillator. It wasn't functioning at all. Even tapping it, nothing would bring it back. So I pulled the crystal out, replaced it, put another one in, and it worked fine. And that's why I just decided to test the crystal, because I thought crystals sort of work in a passive way. If you put a frequency in, it'll sort of pass one exact frequency or pretty close to it. But it was a little unusual what I was seeing anyway. I have a KE2EJ question. I know there's somebody else ahead of me here as far as questions, but I guess I'll check in on that later on and ask it. It's been kind of puzzling me for many, many weeks now, and I do want to try to squeeze it in later on tonight.
Dick, that was probably operating on third overtone, no?
That's right. My best guess is it's the third overtone. Did you get a chance, Joe, of unplugging the bad crystal when you were doing this test into your spectrum analyzer and plug in the good one and see what the difference in response was at 44, 645? Over to you, Joe.
No, I didn't do that, but I didn't throw the bad crystal out, and I have spares of a couple of good ones, just because these things got to be hard to get eventually. Because I use a few of the arrays in my system as links, and I don't want to get into a situation where the radio craps on, I can't repair it because of a lack of a part. So, yeah, I actually have brand new crystals of this type. I have good ones and bad ones. Next week, I'll check back in. I'll actually try to do a sort of a scientific measurement the best I can, and actually look try to graph out what I see the bad one, what that looks like, and what the good one does, with putting simply a wire into one side, wire on the other side, and see how it passes something through it. Back to you.
EB2HWW, with a comment on the last subject, please.
Okay. We got lots of people with lots of comments. We've passed 9 o'clock, and we really should go over to the mailbag. So, Mel, what kind of mail have you had this week? K2KEY, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Mel's not available. What was your comment, Howie? Go ahead.
Comment is, I am using a two-pole crystal filter that I bought from a company down in Florida. I don't remember the name of the company because it's up at the site. I use it on 10 meters in front of a 10-meter receiver. And the thing is, two SO239s, a two-pole filter, gives me about 1.8 dB of insertion noise and around 50 to 60 dB of roll-off at about 100 kc. The window is only about 15 to 20 kilohertz wide. You can't put more than 0 dBm in, or more than maybe 1 or 2 dBm, or you'll blow it. But I just wanted to make a comment that it's an RF filter. I don't know if they're running it on the fundamental or how they're doing it, but this thing is a crystal filter. It's a crystal front-end filter, and it's very selective.
And once again, what was the frequency of that one, Howie?
9.560. I use it on my 10-meter repeater. It sits right in front of the 10-meter receiver, because it's a broadband receiver, you know, 28 to 30 meg, and I needed to get a cavity in front of it. Cavities are too big. This thing is about the size of a little pack of cigarettes. It has two SO239s on it, and it has some capacitors. I've never opened it up, but the schematic has a couple of capacitors and a two-pole filter. Two crystals, and it gives you about 1.8, 1.75 dB attenuation, but the roll-off is tremendous.
What's your best guess as to its bandwidth, Howie?
At 100 kc, either side of FO, I'm down 50 dBs. About 20 kilohertz if I look from 3 dB points. But the bandwidth is basically a single frequency, single channel bandpass. But at 100 kc's above or below, it's about 60 dBs down.
Boy, that sounds like an awfully nice filter, as long as you want to pass that particular frequency. You may have said, and I may have missed it, what brand name, how many dollars, and only a dB or two of insertion loss? Fantastic. So that can eliminate an awful lot of birdies, and when you're on a busy site like you're at, I think one of the sites you use has got a lot of antennas. That could save an awful lot of grief. Except, and crystals like that, crystal filters like that, can probably tolerate a pretty strong signal as long as it is off the resonance. On the resonance, you were saying, don't hit it with more than a milliwatt. So you got to make sure you don't transmit through the darn thing. That sounds like an awful nice thing. What brand name and how many dollars, Howie, and how'd you find out about that? Over to you, Howie.
I don't remember the name of the company. It's located in Florida. It was $300. It took about 8 weeks. They make it right to your frequency. I use it on the 10-meter input of the repeater on my receiver so it doesn't pick up any crud. I will say that I got a quarter wave stub in front of it to guarantee DC lightning protection. I wonder if they make it up to 6 meters, because I got to find out. But it's $300. It has two SO239s on it, the size of a little pack of cigarettes. Very small, and I don't remember the name of the company. They're located in Florida, and they make crystal front-end filters, crystal front-end. And I think it's designed for single frequency. It is also... These filters are also designed to go between a local, like an oscillator, and the next stations if you really want to clean up something. But they tell you the maximum is one to two dBm. No more than one to, maybe no more than one dBm, they say. But it's got a lot of sharpness. You just don't want to drop it, and you obviously don't want to transmit into it. But it's just, and they also make a four pole filter. I didn't buy that, and that costs $500, and they claim close to 90 dBs at 100 kc's off. They claim about 90 dBs at 100 kc's from FO.
Cummins,
VH-1-1-Y.
And by the way, I'll give it to you, Dick. David Joe knows the company. A friend in the paging business told me about this. Somebody I know in the paging business, his name is Alex, and he owns a 10-meter repeater also. And he said, look, if you want to get rid of some anamide and you don't want big cavities, he said they use this in the paging business around 35 megs. Go ahead, Dick. And I guarantee you Joe probably knows who I'm talking about.
Yeah, we're going to go to Wesley and Joe in that order. You first, Wesley, and please wait for the beeps.
Yeah, talking about quartz, at first, people with questions, I would like to refer to Eric. Was in my lab, and I've seen the state of the art when he was for the first time. I remember I've got the vector network analyzer at that time, and he was checking that. This guy has a really knowledge in this area. Now, the second thing is I'm holding in my hands K&L Quartz Tech 21.4. Megahertz with 100K bandwidth, And I was checking this one on Vector Network Analyzer and on impedance gain phase analyzer. And this is what they say on it is there. All right, third comment that I have, ladies and gentlemen. When we were talking about the mechanical resonators, there was one thing that I want to mention. The Q of the mechanical resonator can attain far higher than that of an old electrical LC circuit with no exemption to it. And this is made possible for the construction of mechanical filters with the excellent selectivity. But there is something that nobody mentioned before. It is very much obvious with Kokusai Electric Company mechanical filters. There is always a no exemption to it. Whenever you have an electrical filter, you have the LC circuit in front and LC circuit at the end of it. And that's what makes the narrows. Back to you.
That's excellent. A properly designed launching network, receiving network, and then the actual filter in any of these mechanical or surface acoustic wave or piezoelectric filters. There's an art and a science to it, but as Wesley was telling us, the quartz itself is capable of quality factors like a million, whereas an LC network, you have an awful lot of trouble approaching 1,000. Most of the LC filters we use have got numbers like 200 for their actual Q, which really means the bandwidth divided into the center frequency, so they're nowhere near as selective. I think it was Richard wanted to make some more comment on this. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, Zebra Union Mary standing by.
You get to pick up Joe.
That's right. I'm with you. Sorry about that. It was Joe. We're gonna...
Why?
Yeah, I got you mixed up. Joe and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, I've been listening to your conversation, Ian. You said the crystals normally are not run too much on their fundamental frequency above 20 to 25 megahertz. I came by some filters quite a few years ago that come out of, and I still have them actually, that come out of equipment I was using in the old IMTS service. These things are used at UHF frequencies. They're very constructed into a small can with phono jacks on them, on each end. They were, from what I was told, very expensive to get made, and they were cutted frequencies around in the 459 megahertz region, like 025, 075, something like that. I've got the exact frequencies. I have two or three of them. But I'm just wondering if the thing can't be, the crystal's actually operating at that frequency, is it actually something with a multiple of the original cut in the frequency? Because I do remember measuring these things, and they had something similar to what Howie was discussing about the filter, where these things are extremely sharp in bandwidth, almost like you look like you're sitting on a tack when you hooked up to a tracking generator. They exhibited something I've never seen in an LC type of circuit at UHF as far as the bandwidth. Back to you.
You're in standing by.
I could be wrong, but when it comes to resonating crystals used for frequency determination, it is my belief that they're not used beyond something like 25 megacycles, and anything beyond that frequency, and maybe it's 28 megacycles, but anything beyond that has to be for a ordinary crystal resonator, has to be a harmonic mode, that the piece of quartz gets so thin, the power level at which you could run it at, and so on, would be a difficult fabrication. It would be easy to destroy it. I think there's a whole lot of reasons why you don't want to go there. Glenn, I know you've got quite a few comments on all of the above. KC2, QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Interestingly enough, Dick, no, but I was just wondering, is my audio back?
Good, standing by.
Yeah, your audio sounds very good. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, it actually turns out the batteries in my microphone. My MC60 actually wore out, so I don't use this radio all that often. I'm going to pass it back to you, Dick, but thanks for the audio report. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, there was a KC2ZUM, I think it was. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. Okay. The next person on our list with a real question was John, KC2WGB. Go right ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. I have a question for you. I was thinking about that when I was answering that other question. There's a, when I had to go to the tool crib or the equipment quit to pick up these test capacitors and things like that, whenever we had to get a standard electrolytic capacitor that wasn't used like in 6 months, you had to reform it, and we did that by putting it back on its rated power supply and left for 24 hours to reform it. I'd like to know what exactly is going on with that, and what is it? What does that accomplish, if you're familiar with that reforming?
I think Glenn's the guy to answer that question. Glenn, what happens when you're doing this reforming of an electrolytic capacitor, when you slowly sneak up on its voltage? KC2QIQ, if you're there. K2RIW, sound good.
Yeah, I've heard of this with capacitors that have been left... unused for a long period of time or on a shelf, that sometimes the electrolyte inside them almost deactivates. My personal feeling about this is that, and I know people have had good luck bringing them up slowly with variacs without having the capacitors fail, but I actually think it's actually something nearing a failure mechanism for the capacitor. I think if you're trying to restore very old equipment, bringing up the voltage slowly, sometimes you can get them to come back. Parallel banks of capacitors would have me really worried. Honestly, I think when you run into that situation, you're better off replacing the capacitor, because what's really happened is the electrolyte de-energized itself, and you're trying to set it up again. And it's generally, in my opinion, at least anyway, I don't think it's a very good idea. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me dig a little bit deeper into that one now, Glenn. Any of these electrolytic capacitors we use, tantalum, the paper type that used to be in the old radios, all of these polarized capacitors, obviously there's something very different about the positive plate and the negative plate of that capacitor. I think that what's on that plate is a little bit similar to what's on the positive and negative plate of a lead-acid battery. I mean, the positive plate and the negative plate of a lead-acid battery are very different in their composition. So in the process of charging your lead-acid battery, you're restoring that difference, so to speak. If your electrolytic capacitor has been left inert for a long period of time, sitting on the shelf, so to speak, on the assumption that the electrolyte did not dry out, assuming you've got a good hermetic seal and that none of the fluids inside have left, that's another nasty thing that happens with these paper capacitors. Let me drop this. Your 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor that's in your Cornell Dubilier Ham M rotator. There's a zillion guys out there who think that the grease has dried up and the bearings are not working correctly because the motor won't turn anymore, won't turn right away. And almost 98% of the time, you test that 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor and you find out it's down to 8 microfarads instead of 120 because it dried out. In fact, I remember buying them at Harrison Radio right off the shelf. At times, they had very low capacitance because sitting on the shelf, not being used, they were drying out. So AC capacitors are something very different. But when it comes to DC capacitors, I see the possibility of slowly bringing it up where you reform the difference on those positive and negative plates, and as long as the electrolyte is still there, I think you can come back to near 100% performance that you used to have when the capacitor was new. If you were using the capacitor day after day, this electroforming process would automatically happen. That's a bunch of opinions on that one. Glenn first, and so Glenn, tell me if you agree and if you've seen any evidence along those lines. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
K6DV, who knows that with a comment?
How recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, here again, Dick, I think a lot of this has to do with the composition of the capacitor itself. If you look at like a modern one today, and even some of the older ones, basically they were just aluminum, and on both sides, no additional plating. It's really the electrolyte itself and the dielectric. Now, what will happen is if the electrolyte de-energizes, in other words, if it just sits there long enough, theoretically, one could apply a voltage backwards and reform it in the other direction, in which you can make the minus terminal plus and the plus terminal minus. Here again, when you run into that situation with capacitor, I know that people have done it, they've had success, but I think also here again, it's just one of those things where, depending on how well the electrolyte held up as with the dielectric, it kind of basically tells me that it's probably a good time to replace the capacitor, but that's just my opinion, Dick. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KG2QIQ.
Further info, Dick.
Okay, John recognized. So we've got right now Wesley, Hal, and John in that order. Wesley, go ahead with your comment on reforming electrolytic capacitors.
Entering. First, I propose to go a little bit to the basics, and then I say why I think it's happening. The capacitors store energy as well as the charge. So the charges are generally stored in conductive plates, and the one that is positively charged is called anode, the negatively is called cathode. Okay, now we know that. In order to keep the charges separate, the medium between the anode and cathode called the electric must be non-conductive as an electrical insulator. And the anode and the cathode are configured so there is a very little movement that occurs between them as they are charged, and the force of the electric increases. So the stored charge increases, the electric field across the electric increases, the situation gives rise to the voltage, which increases the proportionally with the charge. Okay, now, where is the problem? Well, the energy stored in the capacitor is the energy required to move the stored charge through the potential of the capacitor. So the capacitor of the device depends mostly on the plate geometry and the nature of the electric. Then we have a problem when, let's say, the charge and the voltage on the given capacitor are increased, and at the same point the dielectric will no longer be able to insulate the charges from each other, and the dielectric then exhibits the dielectric breakdown or the high conductivity in some areas. Why is that happening? Well, this phenomenon is undesirable in most of the capacitor applications. Let me stop. Capacitor damage or destruction can occur in such situations when the normally breakdown ratings for the dielectrics are expressed as the maximum field strength, which is basically the ratio of the applied voltage and the electric thickness. When the capacitor is stored for a long period of time, the chemical activity of the fluid in it is simply put into the sleep. Now, when you first start that, the chemical reaction doesn't really go the way that you want to go, because that fluid actually is not really in the active mode. I know if I express myself properly, but too.
I think I see what you're saying, Wesley. You're saying that there's a wake-up procedure required for the dielectric material. Interesting. Let's see what Hal's got to say on all this. K6DPZ. K2RIW, right, Hal.
K2RIW and the TechNet, K6DPZ. I just wanted to say, a lot of people ran into problems when you're talking about the rotator non-polarized capacitor. And a good way of getting around it, if you don't have an NT cap, take two 240 microfarad electrolytics, tie them back to back, and you got an NT cap, you throw it in, and the rotator will work like it never worked before. Go ahead, Dick. This keeps its dark purple zombies.
Yeah, in my opinion, a much more sophisticated approach that I've used on many occasions is to go to an electrical supply house and buy a motor start capacitor of 120 microfarads AC electrolytic. Those things are made with nice, high quality, great big black plastic package with two really zofty terminals coming out of it, and you put one of those inside of a Cornell Dubilier control head and you'll have no problem for the next 10 years. The idea of taking a pair of double microfarad capacitors, you try to make 120, so you pick up a pair of 240s and put them in series. Yes, you make 120, and you set them up back to back. And if you're a purist, you'll put diodes across them to make sure that they only get the right polarity, because when you take a polarized capacitor, 240 microfarads, something like 120 volts, and you put them back to back, the way the electrolytic capacitor works is that in the forward direction, you're charging the capacitor. In the reverse direction, when you first start the thing up, it goes through some kind of a weird conduction mode, which it eventually settles down with the both of them forward bias. But you can speed up the process and not be putting the capacitors under grief if you put diodes across them. So, from my point of view, the sophisticated approach is buy the right capacitor, a motor start, and if you're going to use a pair of back-to-backs, if you're a purist, I think you should put diodes across them. Lots of guys have done it, not putting the diodes, and gotten away with it. I just don't think you're going to get quite as much longevity. That's just an opinion. I actually haven't actually run the test to prove it. Al's apparently done it. He's run into no grief, so there's a testimonial. Let's see what John's got to say about all this. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, and John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, I was just mentioning that because I wanted to get an idea of what was going on. Because don't forget, these were standard capacitors, very expensive, very large, but low in values. They were 10 mic, 100 mic, things like that. But they had like bus bar coming out of the top. And if they hadn't been used in 6 months, we would have to, what they called, reform them before we could go and make our laboratory experiments. So, and it had to do with the accuracy and reliability. So I was just wondering what was actually going on. Was it a plate reformation or electrolytic electrolyte reformation? I just didn't know. But maybe Glenn can speak more on that. They weren't bad, that's for sure.
And by the way, where the charge is really stored in a capacitor, everybody thinks it's on the plates. The plates are definitely required, but believe it or not, the charge is not on the plates. It's in the electrolyte. And the way you can get a strong piece of evidence on that is when you're doing high voltage experiments. Let me drop.
Comment.
We're going to be going over to Glenn first, Wesley, so hang in there. He's an expert on the list. When you take one of these Leidenjar-like devices of guys that are doing high-voltage experiments, it's really a metallic cup with an inner metallic cup, which is slightly smaller in diameter, and there's a piece of plastic in between the two. And you can charge the two of them up to 100,000 volts and then put a spark across the two and draw a nice big arc. When you take that apart, when it is charged, carefully do it with insulated tools, you take the inner cup away from the outer cup with a piece of plastic in between the two, then you remove the piece of plastic, and you can take the outer cup and the inner cup and touch them to each other. You will not get a spark, or you'll get a very minor spark, but obviously by touching them to each other, you've discharged them. Now you put the thing back together. You put the piece of plastic in the outer cup, and you assemble the inner cup in between, and you do a test, and you'll find out that 80% of the original charge is there. That's a strong piece of evidence that the charge really was in the plastic. It's in the dielectric material. So that doesn't quite meet common sense. Now, that's a high-voltage Leidenjar-like capacitor, and obviously you can't disassemble the kind of electrolytic capacitors we're talking about to reproduce that experiment, but it's an interesting piece of evidence. KC2QIQ. Straighten us out in all this, Glenn, on reforming K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Glenn.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dick, about the, you know, the capacitance being stored, or the charge is actually stored between the plates in the dielectric itself. But what's interesting is if you use the classic equation to figure out the plate size of that rolled-up foil and the dielectric that's being used in the middle, and the area in between, you're not going to come up with a number anywhere near close to capacitance that's marked on the front of the capacitor, although that's the capacitance you're getting. There is a chemical electrolyte used with the dielectric, and that's a very, very key part of an aluminum electrolytic capacitor. And its formation is generally done at the time of manufacture of the capacitor. And I can tell you right now that that's a very, very interesting procedure, and a lot of care is taken in capacitors to get that thing to form properly and evenly. Let me let this drop for a second. Here again, you know, once this thing has somehow discharged the electrolyte, I think that, you know, you can bring capacitors back. I know people have done it, but I don't have a lot of confidence in that capacitor much after that. Another thing about what Hal was saying about putting two aluminum electrolytic capacitors back-to-back up in the rotator application, That's really not a bad application, even without the diodes, because if you look at the temperatures usually associated that a rotator sees in its rotational life, generally are not very high temperatures. Usually they have to withstand cold. And once you pump current through capacitors, even in cold days, aluminum electrolytics might have a little difficulty at the first time you hit the switch, but they warm up automatically and come right into range. And as far as being new off balance, I think as long as you have a good voltage headroom on the capacitors, large enough voltage headroom, the diodes probably aren't necessary. K2RIW, K22QIQ.
Apparently the cap goes in the control box, Grant.
Yeah, Hal, your audio is extremely heavy. You might want to back off a little bit. But yes, what Hal is saying is that the capacitor in the Cornell Dubilier, the AC electrolytic 120 microfarad, 120 volt or whatever it is. No, I think you're only putting 30 volts, but I think it's a 100 volt capacitor. That capacitor is located in the control head, which sits in the shack. I don't know if any of the popular brands of rotators, Cornell Dubilier or Yaesu, whether or not they have the capacitor outdoors in the rotator itself. I think most of them are in the control head. Is that true, Hal? Go ahead.
Yeah, generally that's where they are. They may use one capacitor for reversing the fields on the motor.
Hal, once again, your audio is extremely heavy. You might want to back off a little bit. Want to give me a little bit more audio and try that again?
Yeah, let me talk a little softer. I got the gain up because I was using it on sideband. Yeah, generally they use one capacitor and it works both of the fields. And it's in the control head on most of the rotators.
Does anybody know of a rotator where the capacitor, the AC electrolytic capacitor, is in the rotator itself outdoors? I don't think they put them there. Yeah, I kind of thought not. So it looks like there's an exotic piece of chemistry that's used in that electrolyte in an AC electrolytic capacitor. Glenn was telling us, you calculate the area of the capacitance and some reasonable amount of dielectric constant for the fluid, and you're going to come up with a very small number of microfarads compared to the real number you've got there. There's something exotic about the fluid and its forming process, the exotic piece of chemistry, which really is storing all of that charge and doing all that work. And Wesley has been telling us that there's a real wake-up procedure that when you've not used that capacitor for a long period of time, quite possibly that electrolyte goes into an inert mode and has to be woken back up. Apparently it's got to be woken back up and put back into the active mode with the right polarity with the so-called forming process. Glenn is a little worried about whether or not the capacitors are reliable if you've been reforming them. I'm not quite as worried because I've heard of a large number of amateurs that'll take something like a Heathkit kilowatt or half kilowatt amplifier. And when it hasn't been used for a while, it's got a whole bunch of electrolytic DC capacitors in there. You're really supposed to sneak up on the high voltage slowly with a variac so as not to damage those capacitors. Lots of people have done that, and quite a few of them have gotten away with it, so to speak. The thing worked very well afterwards. A more serious guy will replace all of those capacitors if the thing hasn't been, if they're more than, let's say, 10 years old, because that brand of capacitor does have a dry-out characteristic. A certain percentage of them, the electrolyte will dry out, and you'll never get the right amount of capacitance no matter what you do. And so thorough replacement with quality ones is the safe way to go. Wesley wanted to make another comment on those. Go ahead, Wes. K2R.
WB2HWW, with a comment, please.
Yeah, Wes first, and then Howie in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, and to HGM. Glenn, actually, related to what I want to talk about a little bit before, but we should concentrate on certain characteristic of the capacitor. So one of the disadvantages of the electrolytic capacitor is non-ideal lossy characteristic, which arises from the semiconductive oxide properties. Double layer effects from the electrolyte oxide charge space region, or the resistive losses from the high electrolyte resistivity frequency response. But the anodic oxide dielectric is polar, and so are the electrolytic capacitor in the contrast with the, let's say, classical electrostatic capacitor. That is, the capacitor must be connected with the correct polarity as marked. Say, we want to connect it with the reverse voltage that injects the hydrogen ions through the oxide readily, causing a high electrical conduction, heating, and the reduction of the anodic oxide field. So that is negative, but what is positive in it is that if you take a short impulse of the reverse voltage and you connect it to the capacitor just for the fraction of the second, that's how you wake up the electrolyte in it. Now, let me jump. The nonpolar or bipolar devices use the two anodes instead of an anode and a cathode, and that could be connected with the positive or negative or two identical devices together. So then two terminals would form a nonpolar device, and that's how we have nonpolarized capacitors. That's it.
So therefore, when I buy a Motostart capacitor or some of these other AC electrolytic capacitors, I may not have been aware of it, but there really are a pair of internal capacitors back-to-back in series with each other in order to have AC characteristics. Huh. Let's see what Howie should say on all this. Howie, you got the floor? K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
Paul recognized, but Howie first. Go ahead, Howie.
I want to give it to Paul. Okay, Dick, I've always used non-polarized cap, like one or two mic cap, for audio coupling. When it, you don't know what you're coming from, you don't know if what the polarity is going to be. But normally when you design a circuit, as you would know, if you're using a, you know, a coupling capacitor, and it's electrolytic or it's got a tantalum, you always want the plus to be to the higher voltage. So if you don't know if you're coming from another piece of equipment, like if you're coming from an old tube discriminator radio, in the old days when I used to build up, you know, op amps with de-emphasis, I would always use a non-polarized cap, you know, and always make sure that we're like at 100 or 200 volts. And you never had to worry about, and they're kind of small, you never had to worry about the fact that, that you know, which was the polarity. You didn't have to worry about, well, you only have 6 volts on the op amp side, and you only have maybe 50 volts on the other side. So you could just use a non-polarized. My other really question was this, Dick. It was from last week. It's about capacitors. You know, we've been saying that capacitors have... Let me reset this. With capacitors, that they only have a 2,000 hour, what the load line, you know, what the load line is, what they're under, what kind of current they're drawing. When you're using bypass caps, let's say near transistors or along a bus or something, and you're feeding it with DC, can you really assume that you only have current on turn-on? The last question I had asked, you said, oh, you got to, you know, when you're designing a filter cap, I'm not talking about filter cap with filtering, you know, pulsating DC or the output of a rectifier. I'm mainly talking about when you have a bunch of ICs or you have some op amps or something, and you have a cap across the bus to ground, or where you may have on a B-plus lead a resistor and a capacitor. Sometimes I'll use, let's say, a 5-ohm or a 10-ohm resistor and a cap if I'm drawing very little current through the circuit, and I'll build a simple filter that way. Or in any of the equipment, you know, if we only had 2,000 hours of capacitor life, a lot of our equipment would go bad. Like this repeater has a controller that's on every day. It's got to go through 2,000 pretty quickly. And even if the repeater's out, I got a controller that's been up there. I hope it don't die now, but it's been up. It's been running for like 20 some odd years, and I haven't changed any of the capacitors. I don't know if they're changing. You know, it's not that critical if the cap goes from 10 mics to 6 mics, because it's just being used as bypass. Any comments on that, Dick?
Yes, my understanding is that Glenn was telling us that there are load lines or methods of using electrolytic capacitors in which you might have a calculated possible life of numbers like 2,000 hours. However, that was when you were doing some rather severe things to the capacitor, subjecting it to temperatures it shouldn't be seeing, subjecting it to current it shouldn't be seeing, AC current. Either of these mechanisms that create internal heating, because the capacitor itself has a certain phase angle to it. What would it call it? Loss tangent is one way of putting it, or a power factor, another way of putting it. So when you've got continuous AC significant current flowing through the capacitor, creating internal heating, or you've got the capacitor located alongside of a hot transistor or right on the output of a fan, you can get situations where you have a possible mean time between failure of 2,000 hours. That's my understanding of what Glenn was telling us. But in your particular case, where it's a bypass for a DC line, just to make sure that you don't have any cross-coupling isolation characteristics between a string of operational amplifiers, we'll say, that, in my opinion, is a very low duty factor service for that capacitor, and I think you're going to get a lot more hours, and I don't think you should worry. After we pick up Paul's question, I'm going to be passing it back to Glenn for a confirmation on the hypothesis I just said. Paul, WS2N, I know that you've got some good things to tell us about the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, which five tons of stuff came back, and the best guess is that it dove into the northern Pacific Ocean before it hit Canada, and therefore, I guess the best evidence is that none of that hardware came back on land. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, that's what I heard. Went down into the Pacific. Maybe it's a possibility that some pieces might have wound up in Oregon or someplace, but they believe 99% of it wound up in the ocean. So yeah, so much for that. I think they said one out of 3,200 chance that a person in the world might get hit by something. So that doesn't mean you or me. That means just. It might hit somebody. That's a 1 out of 3,200 chance. So, plenty of water around. So the odds were it was going to hit there. It was a 51 degree inclination. That put it over a large part of the Earth that's occupied. But still no problem. I just a comment on the capacitors. Years ago, maybe 30 years ago, I remember buying these. A company I work for buying these hot start capacitor kits for air conditioner motors that were getting slow. On central air conditioning units, they were getting fired, and we put these things on, and it would really take off. And I was told then back then, and then even read about it that this was really nothing but two capacitors, positive to positive, and that's really what it was. But it's just what you said, like the 120s, Dick, and they really worked good. Thank you.
Yeah. Was I correct in my assumption, Glenn, where Howie is using these capacitors on a fixed, let's say, 12-volt supply, feeding a bunch of operational amplifiers, that's a very low duty cycle service? In other words, not a lot of AC current is flowing through those capacitors. And as such, where you were talking about a potential life of 2,000 hours, I think doesn't apply to him. I think he's running his electrolytic capacitors pretty cool. And I had the impression that almost any of the things that we do that create further grief in the life of an electrolytic capacitor is primarily a temperature characteristic. And as long as we keep it cool and keep the AC current low and don't come too close to the working voltage, we should get some real nice life out of our capacitors, is what I want to believe, Glenn. But we heard an awful lot of the dark side of capacitors last week. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. I mean, load life is a calculation, how long a capacitor is going to last. If you open up the data sheet book on on aluminum electrolytic capacitors, you'll see the load life is one of, just like the voltage rating, ripple current ratings, mechanical ratings of capacitor, load life is one of those ratings on a capacitor. And basically, when a capacitor is operated at its maximum temperature rating, maximum voltage, and maximum ripple current, the load life is the life that's stated. So if it's 2,000 hours with like a lot R, that would be a max temp, max current, max voltage. Now, of course, if you back off on those ratings, the load life of that capacitor increases exponentially. You can really get a lot of life. I've had power supplies where I've demonstrated well over a million hours of load life, Dick. Let me let this drop for a second. So really, load life, voltage ratings, temperature ratings on a capacitor are really for the designer, things to pay attention to. Unfortunately, sometimes they're, because of cost in certain low-cost designs, people will push them to the edge, and things, you know, you'll see capacitors that will wear out prematurely. Other, you know, well-designed units where, let's say, reliability is a key issue, those hours can really, really move out there. If you move the voltage up on a capacitor, you know, the voltage rating compared to where it's being operated, use of capacitors with very, very high ripple current ratings where you're only operating, you know, much, much lower RMS currents through the capacitor, and, you know, you're keeping the temperature way down on them, you know, compared to their peak temperatures, those capacitors will last a long time. Just another quick comment about electrolyte. Electrolyte is the wear-out factor in an aluminum electrolytic capacitor. And when you see a capacitor where there's no longer any charge on it anymore because the electrolyte has either dried out or worked its way back to zero again, and you're able to bring it back, I don't think that that capacitor is one for the world. And I think you could probably see that on voltage ripple and some other measurements that could be made, Dick. And just because a piece of equipment works doesn't necessarily mean it's really within. Sometimes some designs are designed very, very conservatively, so things will still operate. But if you were to go in there with a voltage probe and look at things, they could be pretty ugly. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
C2HWW, with a follow-up question on this comment?
Yeah, we got John and Howie in that order. But before we go there, Glenn, are you sure now that any of these guys who have gone through an electrolytic capacitor reforming procedure, a 10-year-old Heathkit power amplifier, for instance, are you fairly sure that when they followed the wake-up procedure, the reforming procedure for the capacitors, that they've actually trying to restore something that really was essentially destroyed, and that capacitor, that bank of capacitors, is now suspicious from now on, that you would no longer trust them? Have you heard horror stories of guys who have done the reforming procedure correctly and turned out to be unhappy with the result? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'll put it to you this way. I've worked with most of the major capacitor companies that are around today, your Nichicons, United Chemicon, Rubicon, all the Asian manufacturers, and we hold them to very, very strict standards because we have customers who want their life of their products guaranteed. When they tell us, okay, I need an LED driver, and I've got to basically show that that thing's going to last 100,000 hours, okay, I've got, and the capacitor's got a manufacturer's rating of 10,000 hours of load life, I've got to do all the calculations, check everything out, and make sure that capacitor, at the time that we deliver it, has been designed properly and will be operated in the correct region. If something's been stored, an aluminum electrolytic capacitor, like let's say we got a bunch of capacitors in that were stored in a warehouse, and they were 10 years old, and they said, yeah, sure, put these into your unit. Do you think I'd actually put them in product, Dick? I'll let you answer that question. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
Now, the ones that have been stored in a warehouse for 10 years, you're worried that the warehouse got hot and artificially aged them. You're worried that because there was no voltage on the capacitors, that the electrolyte went into some kind of an inactive state. Or what is the major grief that you worried about? The fact that it's 10 years old means that even though it's not being used, still its useful life is being partially consumed. Is there any kind of a test that could be run on those capacitors in that warehouse that are 10 years old that would give you a warm and fuzzy feeling? Or do you only trust capacitors that are months old, strictly, you know, straight from the factory to you, fresh with the fresh new paint smell on them? Are those the only ones you will trust, Glenn? Back to you, Glenn.
No, I'm giving you the wrong impression here. What I'm saying is that if you have a capacitor, a group of capacitors in a box, and you start measuring them, I mean, there's measurements you can make on capacitors. You can check the ESR of a capacitor. You can measure, you know, its capacitance value with a capacitance bridge. There's a lot of things you can look at on a capacitor and really tell a lot about it before you put it into a circuit if you had an old suspect capacitor. But what I'm saying is that if you have a capacitor where the electrolyte is dried out, what that basically means is if you were to put a capacitance bridge across that capacitor, you're not even going to need read probably, you're really just measuring the dielectric capacitance of the capacitor, nothing to do with the electrolyte. That capacitor is, you know, pretty malformed at that point. Now, could you bring some of it back? I'm sure you can. But here again, what that's really saying, more than likely, what the failure mechanism has been from storage is oxidation. Because if you look at oxides, and then you look at the chemical makeup of the electrolyte, what's actually happening is that's what's actually neutralizing the electrolyte. So it doesn't have to be temperature or ripple current or voltage that will degrade a capacitor. It could just, you know, you've got a vent cap on the top, and if oxidation gets inside and pollutes the electrolyte, that's probably what's going on there, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So I think you're saying then the 10-year-old capacitor, you're worried about its degree of hermeticity. How well sealed? In other words, did any oxides get inside? Did any of the fluids dry out? Is that primarily what you're worried about, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that if those capacitors were 10 years old, 20 years old, 50 years old, if they were stored in a really nice factory in Arizona someplace where it was climate controlled and they were sitting in boxes inside, I'm sure they're just fine. But here again, if it was sitting in somebody's damp basement for 20 years or someplace where, you know, there could have been a lot of oxidation and you go to take a look at it or there's a lot of things that can cause oxidation. I think one of the things that could really damage an aluminum electrolytic capacitor that's been sitting a long time is high humidity. And here in the Northeast, and especially here on Long Island, we got a lot of humidity, Dick. So that's why it would make me suspicious. If I lived in Arizona, I probably wouldn't be so suspicious.
Is the W2L amateur radio.
However, it's a two-way situation here, though, Glenn. If the capacitor is in a good package for the capacitor itself, that is well sealed, so that none of the electrolyte is drying out, therefore none of the fluid is leaving the capacitor, I'd like to believe that that capacitor stored in a high humidity environment wouldn't allow water vapor to get back in. That if you really got a good seal, if it's a well-made capacitor, I'm not talking about something that's wrapped in paper here. I'm talking about something that's got glass seals, hopefully, you know, real hermetic seals. If the fluid can't come out, I'd like to believe the humidity can't get back in. Am I being naive on that one, Glenn? Over to you, Glenn.
Hermetic seal is an interesting thing. If it's truly hermetic, I don't think that there's an issue at all. Is an aluminum electrolytic capacitor truly hermetic? I would have my doubts there. There are things that you can do to aluminum electrolytic capacitors to prevent a lot of this? Absolutely. But keep in mind, even with a good, like say, UCC capacitor, which is granted, it doesn't have glass seals, doesn't have a lot of these other things, it's a very well manufactured capacitor. But keep in mind, a lot of corrosion and other things don't have to necessarily sneak in through the vent where the electrolytic is on the top. I'd be worried about it forming on the leads and working its way up from the leads into the bonding points of the capacitors and corrupting the electrolyte there.
I see what you're saying, and I think I'm going to agree with you. The word hermeticity, hermetic seal, in the military world has got an extremely exact meaning. By that I mean, if I'm sealing a package where I've got my very delicate RF amplifier inside, and I want it to be a hermetically sealed package that's never going to grow purple plague and tin whiskers and all these other things are not going to happen to it, the only thing you would really trust is a metal-to-metal welded cover, not just a rubber seal, a welded cover, and the leads going in are glass-to-metal sealed leads. You measure hermeticity by putting it into a high-pressure helium environment where some of the helium molecules go in there, and then with a very delicate instrument, you measure how many helium molecules coming back out. You're counting molecules of helium going past the seal. That's a hermeticity test. Very few things meet that. Your beautiful rubber seal that you think is keeping out water, let me drop, is not really doing what you think it's doing. It is allowing water vapor to go past that rubber seal at some predictable rate. Water vapor will go past the most beautiful rubber seal with silicon grease on it and properly a channel where it goes into, and the metal cover is held down just right. To you and me, it looks like a perfect weather seal. That's not a hermetic seal. water vapor will go past that seal at some particular rate. If it's well manufactured, the rate is very slow, but it's not zero. You wait the right number of years in a high humidity